generation. God gives strength in loving arms, scatters the proud of the nations in the thoughts of their hearts. God takes the powerful from their thrones and lifts up the lowly. God fills the hungry with good things and sends the rich away empty.
Every February since 1976, the country has celebrated the achievements of African Americans during Black History Month. The month-long celebration puts those accomplishments and milestones into focus through social media and in classrooms across our nation. But why February? And was February chosen for any specific reason? It was. Black History Month began as Negro History Week, a label applied by historian Carter G. Woodson in 1926. Now, Woodson was an American historian, an author, a journalist, and the founder of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History. He was bothered by the fact that many textbooks and other historical reviews minimized or completely ignored the contributions of Black figures. And through his Association for the Study of African American Life and History, Woodson earmarked the second week in February to raise awareness of these stories. Woodson chose that week specifically because it covered the birthdays of Frederick Douglass, and his birthday was February 14th, and Abraham Lincoln, whose birthday is February the 12th. And the ensuing publicity led many mayors and college campuses to recognize the week. And then through the years, the groundswell of support allowed the occasion to stretch throughout the entire month of February. And in 1976, President Gerald Ford made Black History Month official, saying that he was urging everyone, and I quote President Ford, "Seize the opportunity to honor the too often neglected accomplishments of Black Americans in every area of endeavor throughout our history." The D.L. Dykes Jr. Foundation, producers of Faith and Reason educational materials and our Faith and Reason 360 podcast, are honored to present a series of conversation with leading Black Americans from Mississippi in observance of Black History Month. And today, I am thrilled to have as our guest my friend, colleague, someone whom I admire, Catherine Young, Senior Vice President of the Memphis Mid-South Mississippi Susan G. Komen Affiliate. Hello, Catherine.
Hello, and thank you so much for inviting me.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Now, Catherine, before we begin our conversation, I'd like to share with our listeners a little bit about you. Now, I know there's a long sheet of accomplishments, but I'm just going to give them a brief window into who you are. You are a lifelong resident of Crystal Springs, Mississippi, which is located near Jackson, Mississippi. Kind of a suburb, right? Okay. And after graduating from Hazelhurst High School, you went on to Jackson State University. And after 3 years, is that correct? You transferred to Belhaven University?
Yes.
And that was where you received a bachelor's degree in business administration and then a master's degree in business management in 2009.
Yes.
And then after graduating, you worked as an adjunct professor of business at Virginia College in Jackson, as well as deputy tax collector for Hinds County. And in 2010, Catherine, you joined the Susan G. Komen Foundation after a friend introduced you to Dr. Wilma Mosley Copton, who at that time was board president of the foundation's Mississippi affiliate. Is that all? Am I good so far?
Yes, you are.
Okay. Now, personally, Catherine, I am proud to be your friend. And as a breast cancer survivor myself, I am most grateful for your work with Susan G. Komen. So, Catherine, I'd like to begin by asking you a number of questions, but I'm going to start with this one. What do you think your unique skills are that have helped you become so successful?
Well, first of all, I would like to begin by saying I am most appreciative to be here and to share my experience of growing up as an African-American woman in the state of Mississippi. It is truly rewarding and fulfilling to have friends that embrace who I am, where I came from, and the path that I'm on. So for that, I am truly grateful to you, my friend, Ms. Dykes, and all of the people in Mississippi who have welded around me and put their arms around me. So I think becoming successful, I am a outgoing person. I'm definitely a people's person. I don't look at color when I call people my friend. I just look at the way that they treat me and how they are embracing me as a professional, as a person, and my goal and vision for myself and the things that I'm doing. I also think that I'm an innovator. I try to look beyond what I see and try to create an atmosphere of what I think it should be to better benefit those that are around me and those that are in my community. If you know me, I am passionate. Whatever I lay my hands to, I am definitely passionate about that. And now I've begin in an era where no is unacceptable to me. That word I try to eliminate out of my vocabulary because I believe where there is a will, there is a way. And through determination and hard work, then I definitely think that I and anybody else can push forward and push through to where you need to be.
Well, again, that's you're saying that is having worked with you for several years now, it is exemplary of who you are and the courage that you portray in everything that you take on. So I wanted to ask you, what is it that led you to this profession now as Senior Vice President of the Memphis Mid-South Mississippi Susan G. Komen Affiliate?
Well, I had no intentions of going down this path. My mother was an educator. My father is an elected official and business owner. And one of my brothers is an accountant. And I just admired his studiousness. He studied, you know, when others would be playing. And he did things that I just so admired about how his ability to and his desire to learn. So in my mind, growing up, I wanted to be a nurse. My grandfather told me that I was going to be a nurse. And then, of course, when my first year of college, nursing sort of fell, and I wanted to be a dentist because I saw I was introduced to a dentist here in Mississippi, Dr. Norman Underwood, and I just admired being able to put a smile on people's face, and that's exactly what he did. So at that particular time, I decided that I wanted to be a dentist. So going to school at Jackson State, an all-black, historically black college and university, I felt the desire to take up chemistry and biology courses for pre-dentistry. So at that particular time,
I was entering into getting married to my husband, and after a year or two in school, we had had our first child. And one of the most disappointing things that I think that hurt me and maybe even shaped my path was I ran into one of my advisors, and she was a white female who told me that maybe pre-med, pre-dentistry, a college itself wasn't for me, that a family, since I had started a family, then that's what I should be. And she didn't think that I would be successful in matriculating through my courses because of my obligations to my family.
Well, that's it. That's disturbing.
It was. It was very disturbing. And I left out of there in a ball of tears, just crying, because I couldn't believe that someone would say that to me, because I was actually asking for advice as to the courses that I should take. And this is what, you know, I was told. So I left there. And of course, you know, I sobbed for a period of time, and I quickly picked myself up. But it's only through my mother, and I'll talk about her a little later, that has always been the person who picked me back up and put me on the path, on my right path, and just give me that inspiration that I needed at the time to move forward.
Well, let's go ahead, since you've mentioned your mom, whom I have met, who I am so impressed by. Let's go ahead and tell me about your family and what it was like growing up in Mississippi, and what was it like being a little girl? So tell us about your family.
So I grew up on a 100-acre farm who my grandfather bought from, at the time, his slave owner.
Wow.
So he worked day and night because the slave master promised him that if he paid him X amount of dollars, that he would sell him this land, which at the time he didn't believe that my grandfather could save that amount of money to purchase the land. So it was just a teaser for him to work the lands and work it much harder.
I'm going to pause just for a moment and share with our listening audience that you are very young, and you just said that your father bought the land from his slave owner. That is within my lifetime. I'm 15 years older than you, 20 maybe. So I just want our listening audience to grapple with that for just a moment. And I'm sorry I interrupted you, but that's an important point I would like to bring out. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Catherine.
So he, you know, didn't think that he would, you know, eventually save enough money. But my grandfather was a very hardworking, determined man, and he did.
Wow.
And so he saved the money. He worked extra, you know, places and extra plantations to get the money, and he eventually saved the money, and he bought it, and which is the same land that my husband and I live on today. So growing up, I saw my grandfather, who is my mother's father, very hardworking. I saw my mother, you know, that was hardworking. My grandmother died when I was three, so most, you know, women, African American women, you know, the grandmother really is the matriarch of the family. And at that particular point, I was only 3 years old, and I remember her, being such a strong individual, that she didn't have many words to say, but when she did say something, you would pay attention to it because she was a person of so many words. And is one of the reasons why I think now I navigate to older people, because I believe sitting at the feet of older people, you gain so much wisdom. And so when my grandmother died, my mother had a brother, and he had three daughters. And so he left them for my grandmother to keep when they were just babies. And when my grandmother died, my mom stepped up to the plate and she adopted the three girls.
Oh my.
And they became a part of our family. Yeah. I mean, of course they were our family already, but being in the same household, and I just saw my mother sacrifice so much that she had her own three children, and she took care and cared for her brother's three children in an era where little money was being transpired through the home. Now, even from a little child, my grandfather and my grandmother instilled in my mother for her education. My mother graduated top of her high school class. She went on to Alcorn State University, all while tending to
six children. Oh my God.
Earned her bachelor's degree, and she got midways to her master's, took a job in Ruleville, teaching, and you know, back and forth, and just working so hard, so diligent, for our family, that she is a true inspiration to me, because this was a woman who bought for her kids and you know, when she didn't have. I remember times when she worked so hard, and we wanted, you know, shoes and clothes that her shoes, the soles had wore out under the bottom, and she wouldn't buy herself shoes. She would make sure that we had coats and things to wear. So an extraordinary lady who I give my life to.
Catherine, I've met your mother, and even to this day, she still comes and supports and works hard, because she has been to so many of these Susan G. Komen events right there by your side helping you. So needless to say, you have received your courage and your strength, guidance from your mother and your grandmother. So Black women in your life have been centerpiece for your achievements and your accomplishments. So
most definitely, and just coming across and how I got to Susan G. Komen, and I know you mentioned that in my bio. I met Miss Gelia Porter, who owns Porter's Insurance, another educator, business owner. She was principal at JPS Schools, and we developed a bond and a friendship. And during the time, you know, I always ask God, what is my purpose? What do you have me to do? And so at the time, I was, you know, in between certain, you know, ideas of where I wanted my life to go. And she called me and she said, well, Dr. Clopton is on the board and they're looking for someone to join the Susan G. Komen employee team. So she said, if you want to send her, you know, your resume, and I've already told her everything about you. Well, when I met Dr. Clopton, it was instant inspiration. And she is another woman that God placed in my life that I think helped push me to become better. And when she, you know, thought that I wasn't, you know, quite doing the things that I would, she's the type of person, just like my mom, pull on your coattail and say, hey, you need to be doing this, you need to be doing mm-hmm. that. You're gonna do great, you're gonna be successful. Just trust and believe in God. So Dr. Clopton is such an awesome woman, and she also, she actually does films. It's called the National Unlimited, which is a film that she does about Black history, and history of Black people in the past. And so we just connected in a way that was just astronomical. We could share stories, and she could tell me about, you know, stories of people that she had come across that she's interviewed for different books and different films. And it's just been an amazing journey, just again, sitting at her feet and learning what it's like to be an African-American professional woman.
Obviously, we are an organization, Faith and Reason 360, which does encourage people to take their faith seriously and to consider what it is that God calls each of us to do, how we respond to others in the world. And so I'm glad you mentioned your faith and your connection to God. And I'm hearing you speak in such a way that you have leaned heavily towards God and embraced your faith to help guide you in the decisions and the choices that you've made. And obviously, you have been put in situations where you've met people that have strong faith that have led you in the choices that you've made.
Yes.
So tell me the name for our listening audience. What is, again, what is, does Dr. Clopton do? She produces...
It's National Unlimited Film, and I might not be pronouncing it right, but you can Google her, Dr. Wilma Mosley Clopton, and you can see some of her films and books and children's books on Black history around the world and also here in the state of Mississippi.
I'm going to spell that for our listening audience in case they're interested. It's CLOPTON. Okay, now that was a little bit of a side, so I want to come back. And as a professional Black woman, what challenges do you still face?
The color of my skin, and not to get too heavily, but at one point as a child, growing up, I wanted to and actually prayed to God to change the color of my skin to make it white or to make it much lighter. So I think as a person of color, there are many challenges professionally that I've endured. I don't think back at school that the color of my skin wasn't an issue when my professor told me that my career path wasn't in that pathway. But as I grew and through several jobs, and one in particular, I was faced with an obstacle where I was going to be given a new position and a position of authority that would have been over white individuals. And during this time, although I had all of the credentials that we would think that if color wasn't a factor, then my credentials would have superseded and definitely I should have been placed there. But because this was an area in Mississippi where racism is still so popular and widely embraced, then I was told that that community would not embrace me as an African American, and especially being at the helm or over other whites. And so this was a devastating period in my life, again, time number two or three, that shook me to my core and again reminded me of my desire as a kid to change the color of my skin to white so that I could compete in a world where white authority, and being white was the way to go in order to get to a professional level where people accepted you.
You went ahead and you took that position, though, didn't you?
I did.
And as a result, you still experienced some individuals as a part of that organization. They withdrew because of the color of your skin.
Correct.
Which in this day and time seems unthinkable to me. But we need to share these stories, and we need to help individuals, and especially children. And you're telling your story, which is heartbreaking for me. But other young black children, females, need to hear this story, and they need to hopefully draw from that courage and to embrace their beauty and their blackness. And so I'm hoping that those young people who are listening to this, and even children who have an opportunity to listen to this, will hear your story and be encouraged and to look at themselves and not have to offer that prayer, which is breaks my heart.
Yeah, most definitely. If you know, if you're feeling that way as I did, I've learned that embracing who I am, the color of my skin, that I within myself, you know, can be great without having to think that just because of my skin color that I won't get to a place of where I desire to be. And so I am definitely embracing who I am, the color of my skin, and even the way, you know, that I talk, you know, this is who I am. This is who God made me. And he's made all of us, you know, the way that we are. And it's okay. It's okay for me to, you know, have dark skin. It's okay for me to talk the way that I do. So
I want to also point out that people, if they would be open to the history of, for example, the Christian tradition, they would recognize that it is without a doubt Jesus himself was a person of color. You don't come from Nazareth and be lily white with blue eyes. That's impossible. And so, and of course, God accepts and encourages all of us to be a part of God's presence in the world. And God certainly doesn't have a prejudice towards color of skin. I think that would dilute God. In fact, if God were to show any kind of partiality towards skin color, of course, that's unthinkable. But again, Jesus was from Nazareth, which is Middle East, and so he himself was a person of color. So I wonder if people even really give that much thought. I do hope that they do, and to consider when they, if they have any prejudice at all, or they look at someone and don't quite see themselves as being able to relate to that person, they need to hopefully see individuals as God sees individuals, and see individuals through the eyes of Jesus of Nazareth, who again was a person of color. So Kevin, you have brought so much opportunity for people to hear your story and to maybe think more carefully about how they move about in the world and how they interact and how they pass judgment on people, which is so against one's faith. God so loved the world. I mean, God loved the world. That means everyone in the world. So I don't want to keep going on that route. I do want to know a little bit more about you. What do you think when you hear Black History Month?
When I hear the word, words Black History Month, I think of the history, the struggles that our foreparents went through, our legacy, and not just a month, but to me a reminder every day that many people sacrifice their lives so that I can be treated, my family, my kids can be treated equal, and live in a world where, again, this, the color of their skin is not a factor, but what contribution can they make to society, to their community, to make it a better place to live and work. And so, you know, growing up, my father, you know, often talked about my great aunt Fannie Lou Hamer. Although I didn't get a chance to see her, meet her, because she died, of course, before I was born. But just his conversation about her and her life in the Mississippi Delta, and just growing up hearing and just listening to various stories, because I, of course, like listening to people talk about things like that, because I believe that it makes me mindful, and it encourages our generation that this was an era where we were definitely not considered equal. And in today's society, unintentional, some intentional racism still exists. And for us to know where we came from and the light in the path for our generation, the generation to come, we can never forget the Black history, our past, and letting everybody know, you know, this is unjust. This is certainly not how people should be treated in a world where we all should embrace and want the same things, no matter what's the color of our skin. Nobody child should die because of injustice through various health care, because they don't, their parents don't have the means to buy food. So, you know, for me, Black History Month is an opportunity for us to highlight those people that made so many sacrifices and embrace what they've done and continue to push forward to eventually their dreams, our dreams, to make them a true reality in a world that we live in today, and set the foundation for those to come after us.
That's wonderful, Catherine. You mentioned Fannie Lou Hamer, and I'm thinking that many of our listening audience do not know who she was, and she was your aunt. So just very briefly, quickly, just mention who Fannie Lou was.
So Fannie Lou Hamer was my great aunt. She was a advocate for civil rights in the Mississippi Delta. She lived in Ruleville, Mississippi, and that is an area in the Mississippi Delta where many African Americans were impoverished. And at the time, she wanted for Blacks didn't have an opportunity to vote. And so she would, have voter rallies. She would participate in so many things. She was jailed, beaten for her voice, or her strong voice and her advocacy to push for African Americans to vote. So just hearing about her and how strong of an African-American woman she was at the time. And then if most people, you know, knew history or you know, or if you are familiar, even women back in that time frame really wasn't considered to have a voice. They were, you know, silenced in many instances, but she wasn't. She was a very outspoken woman who wanted the same thing for her family that she wanted for everybody else. And, you know, she endured beatings. And one of the things that I think drew me or was a perfect fit for me with Coleman was that she died of metastatic breast cancer. But before then, she is often cloned or known as the Mississippi appendectomy. And during her time where research and things was going on, she had an appendicitis and was told that they were going to take out her appendix because of an appendicitis. So she couldn't go to white hospitals. She had to go to a hospital that was designed only for blacks or at a place where only blacks was treated. And so during this time, her female reproductive organs were taken without her knowing. And also during an era where many African-American women, female reproductive organs were taken without their knowledge. And so her legacy is one of, you know, that we can embrace as women, that's just so amazing of the things that she had gone through and was still willing to sacrifice her life and her body for justice and for righteousness.
I am almost speechless because that is such a intimate and personal story, and I hope that our listening audience can have some way to relate to this. So imagine whether you're white or whether you're Asian or whether you're black, just to be a woman and to have taken from you without your permission your ability to give life and to bring new life into the world. That level of injustice is appalling. And we have lived through this. And even to this day, there seems to be some of that that still is present in our culture with a patriarchal system, white male domination. We could go on for a very, very long time about all these different topics that you've touched on, but we're going to not get too deep into all of that. But I do want to bring that to our listening audience's attention, that we as women and as life givers, these are human stories, as well as stories of black women. And obviously you said from the beginning when you were talking about your mother that you have a legacy of very, very strong, determined, courageous black women that have been role models for you in your lifetime. So a couple more questions, because I know we're going on a little bit long. Obviously, it seems like you have mentioned your aunt, and is there any other woman in particular that you really admire that is a part of our history?
Well, oftentimes I think that, you know, as young girls, young males, as African Americans, we look to, you know, stars, basketball players, and you know, other people that we essentially admire, and that's fine, but I found that there are a wealth of individuals that are right here in our community that are unspoken untouched heroes that we oftentimes forget about because they are not in the media. They're not pushed on social media, but they are the ones that are actually the ones that are impacting our lives and pushing us to where we definitely should be. So for me, the women in history is the women that surround me, the women that I see every day, the women that help me matriculate through my life, my career. And there is no greater person on this earth, in my opinion, that I embrace and look to for guidance as my hero, as somebody that I look at their lives and say, wow, other than my mother.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I'm going to have to agree with you simply because I've met your mother, and I too just admire and am awed by her strength and her ability to set a precedence for all the women in your family, your daughter. Mm-hmm. And although you have a grandson now, if you'd had a granddaughter, which you still might have one of these days, but you do. You have beautiful daughters, and your mom is right there with them. Well, thinking about your mom and looking at you now and knowing how important your mother has been in your life, what would you say to your teenage self?
I think looking back, I will tell my teenage self that don't look at the outside. Never look at, listen to what negative comment and energy. Embrace the person within. And I would tell myself that to always, you know, look to those people in my life that have captivated and have went on to do great things and strive for perfection through their eyes or through that lens versus looking in the lens of impossible, looking in the lens of wanting to be somebody that I'm not just because of what I see on the outside or the people on the outside that would seemingly think that color is dirty and bad and ugly. But to know and to understand that I can move forward and I can do the things that anybody else can do with hard work, perseverance, and determination. And embrace those that embrace me and to understand that all people are not anti-black. That there are wonderful white people that know and understand that black people can do the same thing that they can. So I think that I would instill that and I would have a newfound perspective as a younger person that I've grown to understand as an older person now.
Well, and you have no doubt in my mind you have instilled those values in your older daughter, and you have a younger daughter as well, who I am sure you're having that kind of influence on. And just as a little bit of a side, Angel is 10?
She's 9.
She's 9.
But she often says almost 10.
Of course, they always want to get a little bit ahead. They don't realize that the clock never slows down. And when you're my age, you're thinking, oh, let the clock slow down at least just a little bit. But an angel has come into your life through the grace of God just fairly recently. How old was Angel when she became a part of your family?
She was actually probably about 3 months old.
Oh, she was that young?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
So a brief history. So my husband and I, James, we've been married for 26 years and like Angel, almost 27 in June. And we have two children, James Jr. and Brittany. And when we first got married, we knew we only wanted two children, and we asked God for a boy and a girl in just that order, and he gave us that's exactly what we got, a boy and a girl in that order. James came from a family of 10 children, my husband James. So he knew the struggle, he felt the struggle that his father, being the only person working in the family, his mother took care of the children as a whole. So in his mind, he only wanted, or we agreed that, you know, we only wanted two children. And so my youngest, Brittany, was maybe about 10 or 11. We went to church, non-denominational church here in Jackson, and like we had, you know, faithfully been going to. A guest minister came in on this particular day, and James and I was rushing like we always do. Made it there after the service had started. So doing prayer, we had no inclination, no idea, but he said, young man, young lady, come to the front. And so we did, and he said, you all are going to have another child. And so James and I, we just looked at each other, and, you know, we smiled because at that particular time, we knew we couldn't have any more children because we did what it was supposed to, not to have any more children, medically.
Yes, yes.
And so, so we went back home and we laughed and we said, he sure missed God, didn't he? And so little to our surprise, our cousin, she was having a baby, and she was not mentally capable of taking care of this child. She was cousin on my side, on my grandmother's side. And so Angel was diagnosed with spinal bifida. She has hydrocephalitis and had to have a shunt in her head. And they told her she probably wouldn't live passed when she was born, 8 hours or a day after she was born. They immediately did several surgeries on her, and of course my cousin wasn't able to take care of her. And she just fell into our laps. I began to keep her on the weekends. Then I began to keep her, and I, you know, asked my mom to keep her, and it was just like God was telling us, this is the third child that I told you was going to have, but you didn't believe me. And so
the miracle.
So from about 3 months when she had, you know, surgeries and finished, and she got out of the hospital, we kept her.
My.
And she's been with us ever since. I saw her as she began to get older struggle with the fact of identity, of seeing other kids walk and she wasn't able to, and not understanding that her wheelchair was her legs and how she would get around. And so I saw her sometimes being in a shell where she wanted to play with others. She wanted to feel accepted, and she would do, you know, things to try to make herself accepted among, you know, peers at school and things. And so I found her, this organization called Mississippi Wildcats, the only wheelchair basketball team in the state of Mississippi for kids to play wheelchair basketball and see other kids across the world that are just like her, that are strong, that are powerful, that are not defined by their wheelchairs. Yes. And we've seen a 360 turnaround in her, in her confidence. And you know, it's just amazing to see. And she is an amazing child to just watch, not look at what she can't do, but what she can do.
What she can do.
And oftentimes, you know, we'll try to, no, you can't do that, and catch ourselves and allow her to go ahead. Yes. and not let her think that she can't, but allow her to try.
Well, and last weekend, I think y'all were in Atlanta, and you texted pictures of Angel on the basketball court with all of her peers, and it was one of the most heartwarming images and experiences that anyone can share with someone else. So you are remarkable, Catherine. You are not only my very special friend, but someone whom I admire and am so grateful that you are in my life, and so grateful that you came in to share your story with me. And I know we could go on for much longer, but I'll have to have you back at some point. And actually, Catherine, we do the Pink Podcast together.
Yes.
Sometimes. And so that's another area that maybe some of our listening audiences would be interested in, our Sister G. Komen Pink Podcast that you host.
Correct.
For that particular one. But now I think that we will just move into a little bit of closure. Do you have any other thoughts, or Catherine, that you'd like to share with our audience?
The last thing, and I'm not sure how much time we have, but I just wanted to hit on breast cancer just a little bit.
I want you to, please.
You know, for many years, the stigma of women having breast cancer was a quiet and very personal subject that families have. No one talked about it. No one shared it in the family. And, you know, many people thought that this was something that, you know, God had plagued the family with for some odd reason. And this taboo feeling women felt during this time was one of shame, dirty, and unworthiness. And for generations, this shame and fear, you know, inadvertently crippled the way our modern day society, it continues to have a major impact on mortality and morbidity rates, especially in low income areas and of women of color. So for me, you know, this disparity in breast cancer survival has been one of my driving forces. And we can look at, you know, African-American women die at a rate of 40% greater than any other nationality. And some of our, you know, things, mistrust of the healthcare system and unjust treatment that have gone on before our modern day women have impacted our health and our lives in today's society. And some of this, of course, is unintentional, and some is intentional. And some in the medical community unintentionally, African-American women are treated differently than white women, especially if you don't have the resources and a very good insurance policy to cover the astronomical cost of a cancer diagnosis. So in my position and my calling that I think that God have placed upon my life is to help all women matriculate through the healthcare system, decrease our disparities so that no matter what color your skin is, that you're given the same fair, equitable treatment and treatment options as anybody else. That through the eyes of those physicians, they're not looking at a black person across from them, they're not looking at a white person across from them, but they are looking at a human being that is somebody's mother, somebody's sister, somebody's wife. And that same treatment plan that they would give to somebody if they was looking at the person, in another view, that they would give that same treatment or best treatment option for any woman, no matter right. what she looks like. And that is one of the most heartbreaking things that any person can hear or understand, for any Mississippian, is to see a woman die because she wasn't given the same resources and was not treated the same just because of her skin color. Providing those resources for those women and being their voice when they think that they are voiceless, is what I'm here for.
And we have a race every year. Metro Jackson Race for the Cure, that we do every spring, late April, and we raise those funds to help these women, to help address the disparity issues. And an interesting thing that I learned after being a part of the Race for the Cure committee with you is that 80%, is that correct?
75% stay in our community. So Race for the Cure is, of course, the world's largest series of run races across the world that Susan G. Komen started. And for us, this is a very big fundraiser here in Mississippi. And the funds that we, gather are used directly to address some of the issues and bridge the gaps that I've talked about, to make sure that all women, have access. And if for some reason that they don't have access to the proper insurance, then our fundraiser with Race for the Cure will be able to bridge that gap. And so oftentimes our race doesn't raise enough money, if I'm okay with it, doesn't raise enough money to cover the gaps that exist here in Mississippi, because they are so large. It is so many people that we're in the top 10 of women dying from breast cancer at later stages, and majority due to the lack of resources.
And so where the nationally the rate of deaths from breast cancer seem to be declining, but in Mississippi, that is not the case.
Correct.
And there are other races that raise money for cancer, but the Race for the Cure, which is the Susan G. Komen race, it is the only race that specifically raises money to target breast cancer. And so, if somebody wanted to make a donation to the Susan G. Komen Race for the Cure, how would they do that?
Online, we have an online presence at www.komenmemphismsms.org, and you can click on the Metro Jackson Race or the Gulf Coast Race for the Cure if you're donating specifically to Mississippi. and the Memphis race if you're donating towards Tennessee. So Memphis, Tennessee, and Mississippi, as far as African Americans, mirrors itself in the fact that Memphis, Tennessee is an area who is heavily African American, just like the state of Mississippi. And the number of African Americans that are dying in Memphis, Tennessee, also is a mirror of the state of Mississippi. So both of the areas, and is one of the reasons why the two affiliates merged together, because we saw the same struggles and wanted to put our efforts together to address the astronomical needs in a way that was consistent and across our state line.
Well, you know that addressing the issues of breast cancer, and especially in Mississippi, are near and dear to my heart. And so I want to thank you for sharing that with us about your work and your passion for your work with the Susan G. Komen affiliate here in Mississippi. So on that, Catherine, thank you. Thank you so much for a lovely exchange, a lovely conversation about what it's like being a Black female in Mississippi, a young Black female in the state of Mississippi. And I hope our listening audience has enjoyed this as much as I have, and maybe it has been an eye-opening experience as well. So in closing, this has been Faith and Reason podcast. All of our podcasts, Faith and Reason 360 podcasts, are free to our listeners. If you want to know more about Faith and Reason, you can visit us online at www.faithandreason.org. And if you want to make a donation, that's certainly welcome. This program is produced by Faith and Reason, a program of the D.L. Dykes Jr. Foundation.
God chose Israel, remembering mercy, according to the promise to those he made before, to Sarah, to Abraham, to Hagar, to their children's children evermore.